Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
I almost said I'm Francis Zierer.
it's a rare episode hosted by me, and then I left silences, came back in, and recorded a second take.
Just kidding. I'm actually Daisy Alioto.
Mm-hmm. And today,
and I do have a cough drop in.
Today, we have a really fun double feature. We were guests on another podcast, and then they came on ours, which is Future Commerce by Brian Lang and Philip Jackson, who co-founded Future Commerce, I think around 8 years ago now. It's this really great media company. They do newsletters, podcasts, events. I would say that they have an amazing brand, Sillage, which you can learn more about that if you go listen to our appearance on their podcast.
Yeah, this was like such a meta episode. I almost felt like it was like the Being John Malkovich of podcast episodes, where it's like, you know, we're telling the story, but simultaneously we all have like a clay puppet of ourselves that we're like, you know, we're like narrating.
This is really fun. Both episodes, both the one that you're listening to now and then our appearance on theirs, which if you like this one, go and listen to that. It's also already out. Yeah. You know, they've been podcasting for like 8 times as long as us. So I don't know. They're pros.
Yeah. At one point we said, let humans do what humans are good at, let machines do what machines are good at. And I feel like that was the overarching theme of this double feature. And maybe I think one sort of errs on the machine side, the other on the human side. So they're very complementary conversations.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into the episode, I did want to ask about your launch party last week for Blank.
Oh, it was so fun. I know. I keep looking at the pictures like, oh my God, oh my God.
The pictures look so good. I was like, damn, this is luxe.
Well, this is the funny thing about running your own events. When I was freelance and covering culture stuff, I would go to these parties that, you know, a brand put on and put a lot of money into. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you would check like BFA the morning after and hope there was a good picture of you. And there are some good pictures of me on BFA.
But this time you get to make sure.
Well, I had to, only once did I ask BFA to take something out. I don't even know how I got this person's email address. I don't know if it was like general support, but I was like, you have to take this down. I look like Danny DeVito. Mm-hmm. And they literally responded like, LOL, it's gone. And they were like, LOL, it's gone. Uh-huh. We did not use BFA. We used this wonderful photographer named Kelsey Cherry, but the other thing is, like, if you're press, what they do is, this would happen to me when I went to openings. They put you in a Facebook. So if you've seen that like scene in Devil Wears Prada where she's like whispering who each person is, it's a literal Facebook that ahead of time you're like, these are the people that need to be photographed and talked to. And I got to say what the Facebook was this time.
That's so sick.
But it's so funny. Like my first instinct when we got the photo, my first instinct when we got the photos the next day was like, oh, I hope there's like a good picture of me in here. And then I'm like, Daisy, like, it's your event. Like, she took a lot of photos of you. Like, she went out of her way.
You were in the Facebook. You made the Facebook.
Yeah.
It was like, only you in the Facebook.
Honestly, major, major vibe shift for me. But, and also like a lot of wonderful photos of people I care about that are friends and also, in my world, VIPs. Mm-hmm. So it was really like such a wonderful combination of each of the brands involved. Like the Future Perfect was the environment, but the design and beautiful objects and furniture in every corner of this townhouse that people can interact with. I forgot to like warn some of the people that were coming, like, this isn't going to look like a gallery because it's literally just like a townhouse door on this street in the West Village. So people were coming up and being like, this can't be the place. And then they would walk in and be like, Daisy, what is this? Like, who lives here?
This is not my beautiful event.
This is not my beautiful house.
This can't be the place.
And I'd be like, do you want the tour? And we would just like go from floor to floor and be like, look at this, look at this. Even in the bathroom, there's like amazing contemporary sculptures and objects, design objects. So it was fun to see people just like take that in. Also, we were able to intersperse like the lingerie product and imagery from the Something More campaign in a way that like looked super organic and not forced at all. And Taylor, who works with the communications team that was helping Chantal, called Basil, I haven't said it out loud. They were so fun to work with,
too.
Is it
spelled with an irony?
I know. But Taylor, who works with them, found this company called Amazing Graze that built an on-site grazing table with flowers. I mean, it was like an artwork.
Amazing Graze.
Like, Amazing Graze. Isn't that great?
Good. Yeah, that's good.
And just like sculptural flower arrangement. And that was like, whole other thing. I mean, I'm looking at pictures of food because, you know, I didn't eat any of it because I was busy greeting people.
Flitting
I ate
around,
one yeah. cheese cube. Oh. I ate one cheese cube. Anyway, so every element of it was stunning. People had a really good time. And Beth, who works with Basil, and she pointed out after, she was like, there's no phones in these pictures. People did not have their phones
living
out.
In the moment,
talking to each other. I was like, you did it. We did it, guys. We escaped the algorithm.
That's a good, that's for any people who run events out there. I'd say that's a great metric of success. You know, you go through go through the photos. What's the phones per people ratio in your photos?
Yeah. So I was exhausted when I woke up the next day, but I also felt very, very happy that we had been able to combine these three worlds so effectively and give people just like this really beautiful night.
You were blank, but in a state of contentment.
Yeah. No, I hadn't worn heels for that long in a while, and I didn't drink anything. And I woke up and I felt like I was hungover and hit by a truck. Mm-hmm. And it was literally just like, from wearing heels. So
okay. The last thing I'll say, and then we should transition to the episode. I think that your comment about, everyone there, the people in the Facebook were VIPs to you.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good thread for a conversation about the OpenAI, Studio Ghibli.
Right.
Tell us
the scene and the anti-scene of it all.
The scene and the anti-scene. All right. Well, we will hand you over to the episode, which we've already recorded. Go check out the episode on the Future Commerce feed as well, if you enjoy it. So I'm honestly not sure if it is Studio Ghibli or Studio Ghibli, but we are going to, I'm going to say Ghibli. We'll have different, you know, different, there's different
if
ways
we all
seeing.
Say it differently, then it's all the bases are covered.
Yes.
What if I say it multiple ways throughout the conversation?
That's
likely to happen.
Then we'll just cut that.
So this is like that. GIF or GIF, basically.
It is.
Okay. Studio Ghibli, the memes, the spike, the moment is over. It was over very quickly. I think it started on like Thursday, maybe Wednesday. And then by the time that the White House was posting horrific deportation, Ghibli-fied memes, I think it was over. I have a take on this moment, but
speak on
I'll it.
Lay it on. First. Okay. Yeah, I'll start. This one, I kind of got this from Mike Pepe, who is my favorite AI skeptic thinker that
and
we've had on this podcast.
Former Tesla guest.
Read his book, Against Platforms. It's really good. But his take, I think, is the most coherent, which is like this Ghibli moment isn't about like, you know, oh wow, OpenAI is so powerful, it's going to take the artist's jobs, like etc. It's just a top of funnel marketing for Ghibli, where I think Sam Altman posted, maybe this was earlier today, that in the past hour they'd got 1 million new users.
Yeah,
which they hit. They were like one of the fastest companies ever to hit that.
It broke them, and then they announced they raised a ton more money. It's like, how about you?
Yeah.
Actually, serve the base that you already have.
Well, but that's all to me. Like it's not like
no,
a harbinger.
No future, but maybe serve your base.
That's the main thing. That's the main takeaway for me is this was a great marketing moment for them. You know, everyone who changed their profile pictures, that won't last forever.
The word Ghibli anywhere? Because if they did, or did they just allow people to make the association? Because if they used that word anywhere, they absolutely owe him money.
I don't think they did. I don't think they did any official marketing.
But yeah, you guys are probably more up on the laws around commerce and sort of like implied affiliation. But like, what do you think? Do you think there's a case here?
So there's two things that happened. One was they showed a Ghibli style meme on the live stream, the like 13-minute video that was like quasi live on their YouTube that announced the feature, and the actual like X post that kicked the thing off was a post that said there's tremendous alpha in, you know, sending a studio Ghibli style meme of your, you know, to your wife, like of you and your family. So like those two things that happened like basically within an hour of each other kind of put those, like they were of the same moment, because it was like a tacit endorsement of as if OpenAI had posted it themselves, but they didn't say explicitly Studio Ghibli.
So did Sam Altman use the word in a tweet later, maybe?
He may have said it later, but it was more commenting on the moment. I think he might have said it in the moment actually as, and here's like a Ghibli style, you know, version of you as a twink, which I think was also a funny sort of a send up of, you know, him commenting on the moment, which you would think he'd learn his lessons over a lot of things, you know, a la Scarlett Johansson. And I think their legal defense fund is probably quite large too at this point. So
it is quite large. But I also think nobody is, I mean, it sounds crazy to say in this moment, but like, I don't think anyone's untouchable.
That's true. That's true.
Consequences come in like a lot of different forms. Sometimes you just like rot from the inside out.
There was a good piece in the Media Operator this morning,
not fast
Donnelly, about the big media companies licensing their content to OpenAI and other AI companies, and how like maybe it looks like a good deal up front and it's like 90% plus margins, et cetera, you know, especially if you have multiple these deals with multiple companies. But his major point was that like what they're doing is like saying actually it's okay that you stole our content. If you were already using it, like we're admitting that it's okay, we're not gonna like pursue legal defense. But also that the big mistake there is that that doesn't price in the lifetime value of a customer.
Correct.
Off of their content, which I thought was really a really cogent point.
The thing is,
the lifetime value of a customer becomes zero though, the second you acknowledge your content as something that can be replicated.
Right.
I think the lifetime value of a Studio Ghibli like customer has been quite low to begin with. So this is the thing I has been my critique is most people I'm going to get a lot of hate about this, and this is going to get a lot of clicks for you guys. Most people don't consume anime generally. I know that it's huge. Okay. But most people don't consume, like, just go look at the list of Miyazaki films. They don't rank in the top 100 films that gross of all time. So like aesthetically,
is that domestic or global? I mean, the global anime market is
large. I mean, if you rank it as far as like manga, and you rank it as far as, especially like TV streamers. Yeah, sure. But I'm talking about Ghibli's market share.
Right. These are not Marvel films.
They are culturally important, but they're not commercially the most important things that have ever existed, right? Mm-hmm. Spirited Away, one of the most like beautiful, most important films in my household. Okay. But you know, like Ponyo, like real, like I don't know. I understand that this is like a participatory economy, Henry Jenkins sort of a moment where like when the barrier to entry is sufficiently low, anybody and everybody will participate. And this is something that's been theorized for a long time. This is what's happened in commerce, right? We dropped the barrier to participation for commerce to the floor, and Shopify made it so accessible for anybody to participate in commerce. And you know what we have? We have a sea of homogeneity. Every website looks the same. Every website functions the same. We have drop shippers that have overrun the universe with like Chinese flood goods all over the planet. We have courseware all over TikTok. We have, you know, AliExpress, you know, products getting jacked up 2-3 times X. We have influencers all over this is what happens is when you know, Henry Jenkins talked about this 20 years ago, when the bar for participation is sufficiently low, everybody participates. And so, you know, I wrote a piece about this for Future Commerce on Friday about this phenomenon. And, you know, Walter Benjamin talked about this, and Walter Benjamin said that with which withers in the age of mechanical reproduction is the aura of the work of art. And I think that's sort of where we are right now, is like we're left with nothing left but the aura. Like we're the only thing that will be remembered left is the aura, because everybody's participating in just the mechanical reproduction.
But the aura relies on the original. It's the sillage, to steal Francis's term, of the original. Like, I wasn't going to wade into this or have a take. And I was actually really busy. I think it was Thursday, because I remember I was really busy, and I think I was running around before my blank launch party. But so
I mean, look, I'm not above like generating one of those. Like if I had had more time that day, I 100% would have done one of Ben and I, but like,
I am, but okay.
Whatever. I ended up accidentally going viral for having a take by just like reposting something I wrote over the winter, which was like about attention being what makes us human, being the actual scarce resource, being something that you cannot replicate with a computer. A computer can develop taste in a sort of predictive way and preferences, even autonomous preferences, but it cannot consume art and culture the same way human beings do, because art and culture is something we consume with our whole body. And this is like supported obviously by science and neuroscience, which takes into account that the endocrine system has a really big role in how we perceive beauty and art. And actually it's not settled how many parts of the human body contribute to that perception. Anyway, like I was basically saying, like, everyone's responding to this because everything looks so good in this style, but why? It's because like that style already existed. Every association that you have with it already existed. The aura and the prestige around what Miyazaki created for the culture exists. And so your response to any image in that style is going to respond to your feelings towards the original. It's not just that it looks cool. You can't just say that it is that it looks cool. And so I think that that was like, that's like a really important point, because we, and I was thinking last night, going back to a conversation I had with W. David Marks, friend of Dirt, and friend of Future Commerce, I assume, about his book, Status and Culture.
I have it right there. It's right there.
I mean, incredible book. But the thing that he has talked about that really stuck with me, because it's not something that I think I probably intuitively understood it in the way most of us do, but I couldn't articulate it until he articulated it for me, was like the way that counterculture and culture operates in just a cyclical way of like really challenging fringe things being developed and then integrated. So like Morgan Wallen, who thinks he's too good for SNL in New York City, sings in a genre that only exists because of the fringe, underground, you know, primarily Black music that was developed earlier in the history of the United States. They eventually got integrated into, you know, country top 100 or whatever, country top 10. So if you don't support, though, that fringe, like if you're not willing to have things like drag shows or starving artists or housing programs for people that aren't making money off their art yet, you cut off that cycle at its legs. But you cannot have a cycle of normie thing to normie thing. The normie things just get worse. They degrade in quality. The cycle is meant to be challenging counterculture thing that nobody likes, John Cage, that nobody understands, eventually trickling down sort of like that Devil Wears Prada Cerulean Sweater moment into something that becomes monocultural until it's challenged by the new fringe thing. And what we have right now is not just political fascism. We have a certain amount of people that have fascism of their aesthetic taste and their sense of their values of what is culturally normative. They consume things that started off as incredibly weird and they can't acknowledge it. And they don't realize that there's not going to be a next wave of things for them to consume because there's nowhere for culture to go.
Right.
And so
that's part of the stagnation.
Yeah, that's part of the stagnation. So long way of saying, like, there is still room for the original. The AI referent is going to play off of and become popular off of. But there's no support in our culture right now for the next Miyazaki that millions of people could crash OpenAI mimicking. Like, we're not producing things that will be mimicable by AI. That's the bigger problem.
Right.
People who do break through and continue to create original stuff that actually has aura in this, quote, taste economy, if you want to call it that, like, will have so much power. But it's an absolutely a financial, cultural, and political uphill battle right now to even get to that point.
Right, because you have to have a critical mass in order for it to have effect. I actually covered this back in 2019 in my piece on replica sneakers and the value of art. And because there was a huge problem with replica sneakers and people were kind of like freaking out, and then they kind of took on an aura of their own eventually. But I think that I've thought about this problem. I kid you not, since I was young, because I was like, copies are everywhere. I mean, this conversation was happening back when like Thomas Kinkade was popular. It was like, how is this worth
the money? Did you see his trove of drawings that they released, and they look like George Bush drawings?
Exactly. It's ridiculous.
I roasted him on Twitter. They're not
I saw good. That.
The it Disney ones are better. He made the right choice.
But my I think where I landed was, I actually think that it's actually the creator, him or herself, that actually like brings the value to the art. It's getting to know that creator. There's inherent things that are infused into pieces of art that are worthwhile, that are either developed or just like inherent in that artist. And the closer we get to that artist and understand that person, the more we're going to ascribe to that piece of art. And so in fact, I would contend this Ghibli business is us wanting to be closer to that art, like taking part in it is actually getting us closer to the artist, because we can be a part of the style. And I also think it's a flash in the pan in many ways. Like it's something that we got to do for fun on the internet for like a week. Like,
that's generous. I think that's generous.
The end game is like, I guess my son is an artist. He is incredible. And I,
He really is. This is like, this is not a proud dad thing. His son's a genius.
I think about his first painting and what it means to me. And like, I know him and I love him and I care about him more than anyone else does, you know, aside from his mom. And so for me, that painting has the deepest amount of value. Because he is by nature an artist. And so like, my other kids have other things where I'm like, I deeply value that thing, but it's because I know them and love them. Mm-hmm. And so I think about all of this other art and all these things that are sort of swirling around. I actually think that people have lost track of what gives art value in general. And that is its creator.
I'll say, okay. So one thing, the way you're talking about how, you know, the phenomenon here is that people want to be close to the art. They want to feel more relating to it. It reminds me of like when I was in third grade and I had a dream that I was in Lord of the Rings because I'd just seen the movie, right? That's when one of them came out. And this is like that, like the AI thing is allowing you to like see, well, what if I was in the movie? And I think we're talking about all this, you know, using the word art a lot. I don't think either any of you would argue with me. These aren't art. They are Snapchat filters. You know, if I take just a photo with my iPhone of like my friend walking down the street, it's not art. It's a photo. Because it's a photo doesn't mean it's art. You can make art maybe with like, you know, using the specificities of AI as a medium, like finding flaws in a model. Maybe you could curate like this massive grid of these Ghibli photos, whatever. I don't know. But I think I don't think it's controversial to say that like these things aren't art. I like to use, when I see something that, you know, it looks like it was fun to make, you know what I mean? And maybe not much more than that. The last thing I'll say here is, art. And like, when you see, there's like that meme of like, I think it's like a Clifford Still painting or whatever. And it's like the Chad, like, this is art because it has real emotion. And then there's below it, there's like this AI generated kind of abstract image of a woman's face, and it's like, this was fun to make, and it's art. And the, you know, the Chad virgin meme, the virgin guy's like, oh, it's not art because it's, you know, whatever, I forget. But the point is like, the Clifford Still thing is a painting that's like 10 feet by 6 feet tall, and then this other image is an image that has no size. It's just a PNG that's like maybe an inch wide on your screen. And I think that's another big difference here. There's a lot of different threads there, but
no, I the first time Daisy, you and I met in real life, we were at the taping of one of our Vision Summit content pools and at MoMA a couple years ago, and we were exploring John Berger's Ways of Seeing, right? And you know, part of that was, you know, how do we explore that in a commerce context, right? So one of the things we do at Future Commerce is we sort of take these elements of like cultural exploration, or, you know, cultural commentary, and we sort of bring it to the commerce world, which is something that literally nobody has asked us to do. but we do it anyway. And so we take these, you know, these ideas and we sort of find this overlay and like, how does that apply to the world of commerce or the trade of commerce, often the trade. And that to your point, you know, John Berger in the first, in the original BBC broadcast and then the first few chapters of the book, sort of explores that is that you have no sense of context of a painting that's been reproduced in a book. You know, his thing was the book and then the television image. You know, the Mona Lisa was meant to be, you know, controlled in a very specific room with specific lighting, you know, with like roped off barriers and a number of people in a, like it's a controlled environment, but no longer do we have control. Right. And, we actually had a, when we talk about that in our salons, right, we have a lot of control over our salons. We have no more than 20 people. We very specifically curate the room. And we have, you know, these are 3 or 4 hour affairs. Brian, you know, has, you know, wines older than God himself, you know, in this room. But we, you know, we'll have, this conversation and at one of these salons we had, about a year and a half ago in Boston, we had Fred Rackheld, and Fred is the creator of the Net Promoter Score, NPS. I don't know if you've heard of that. Some people have, but NPS is this like measure of, you know, who is a promoter of your brand, product, or service. And a lot of brands use this as like a one click way of saying whether you had a great experience or not. Right. And Fred, he's a Bain fellow. He's also a very rich fellow these days, but he's a Bain fellow. And he's saying in the modern day, he's telling us in the salon, in the modern day, NPS doesn't really hold up because you can't control the context in which someone buys something, in which they receive the package, in which they receive the survey. So think about that. Like the context in which somebody receives the survey is as important as anything else. You ask somebody when they're, you know, the pot of pasta is boiling over and their kid's crying and the dog's puking on the carpet, how their experience was, there's a very different perspective to how, you know, how they rate that experience than, you know, if everything's going splendidly in their life.
Well, that's, I mean, and for the same reason, AI cannot perceive art.
Yeah.
Because the attention, the variation in your attention to the survey is the same in the variation in your attention to Monet's water lilies. And you could go to the museum and your kid could have a meltdown and you could say, this was my least favorite room. But AI will always have a consistent experience.
Not all attention is created equal.
Yeah.
I think that's really important right now, it being in the attention economy, like understanding that attention can be very diverted in different contexts. And like, I sometimes have to read something like 5 times before I understand it or like get it because I've like can't wrap my mind around it for whatever reason. It, you know, I think there's a difference between like weak attention and strong attention as well. When people aren't paying for something, they haven't given it like actually their full attention.
Say that again. I wasn't paying attention.
No, I actually I was on a call yesterday with a producer and I was like, I got an email from my accountant and I made the mistake of reading it. I missed like what they said to me, you know, the end of a sentence or something. And I just said like point blank, hey, can you repeat that? I zoned out. And they sort of laughed like, that's like really funny that she's just saying like explicitly I zoned out. But I'm like, well, that's what happened. So anyway.
Gosh, we all need to be a little more like a real. I think that's just the world we live in now.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I was going to say was, we have an ongoing bit on this podcast about like me bullying ChatGPT, trying to get to the psychological source of like why I can be so patient with other people. But I really like ChatGPT getting something wrong actually sends me into a primitive rage. Mm-hmm. Similar to like when I go to the grocery store, you know, those like little things that like just roll around. They don't even look like humans. I don't really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
I like, there's something about like the Neanderthal part of my brain that's like, kick it over. And I'm not a violent person. And I realized, like, I think I'm starting to have some more revelations about what my issue with ChatGPT is psychologically. And I realized it's because I want it to feel shame. When I get things wrong, when I'm dishonest, I feel shame. And I believe that ChatGPT should feel shame when it gets something wrong and it doesn't. And that enrages me. Mm. And I think that says something very interesting about myself and my psychology, that there are parts of my personality that are shame driven. But it's another way in which like these models, you know, they can talk to you in a human way, but like, if I say, why did you lie to me? It'll say I made a mistake, but it doesn't feel shame. And that's really interesting. The other thing I was going to say in terms of like, what's art and what's not art is I've been meaning to tell Francis, I was going to tell you earlier over the weekend when I finished it, but I figured I'll wait for the grand reveal, which is I finished my poem about the Polo Bar that is made up entirely of sentences of reviews of the Polo Bar. And I read 500 TripAdvisor reviews of the Polo Bar to write this poem. And I think it actually came out pretty good. It's called The Polo Bar. Yeah.
It's a great name.
Is one of them your own review?
No, I've never been. Okay. It's actually really hard to get a reservation. So I was like, this is a better use of my time.
I thought about hosting an event there. It's actually on my list. It's
well, if you private do, rooms. I will come.
It was not, I would have expected something less like, more on the line of like Balthazar from you.
Balthazar is like, it's easy.
That's Daisy's thing, isn't it?
I'm fascinated by the Polo Bar because I think it was at the peak of popularity when I first started paying attention to restaurants as an indicator of somebody's taste, because it was around the time where I started making enough money in New York to actually go out to eat. And also around the time I think that I was freelancing for GQ and they were writing about the Polo Bar. So I think I just imprinted on it like a baby duck.
nice.
Oh, go ahead.
We had you covered a number of topics. That was something that we did in our research and trends report in 2022. And so we could like send it over to link up. But it was a piece that we covered in our modernity section called Our Shitty Robot Future. So this came out in June of 22, which was, I think 2 months after DALL-E 2 or DALL-E 1.5 that had been released, and it was about 3.5 months before ChatGPT. So just to give you a time frame on like where we were in the grand timeline. So we were sort of like pre-LLM. When this report landed, it was also 3 days. I remember very distinctly, Brian, it was 3 days before Blake Lemoyne ran to the U.S. senators and said, Blake Lemoyne was the whistleblower at Google who said they have God in there. It was the guy who was convinced that he was speaking to God inside of Google.
Out of the machine.
But we had put together this report because it. You know, you were talking about, you know, the inventory robots at in like the stores. And how we sort of anthropomorphize them to make them a little more tolerable. There was a Michael Corkery piece in New York Times that we cite in this piece from back in 2020 about, I think the title is Should Robots Have a Face? And, you know, in the 5 years hence, I don't think we've evolved past the question of should robots have a face. I think we've anthropomorphized everything. We're into full-on parasocial relationships with all sorts of robots. There's robots for everything. We're into agentic relationships now. We have, you know, we're deep in a commerce in the commerce industry. We're deep into a conversation now about like personal shopping robots and like making your site easier to navigate for personal shoppers, and like how do we deal with like the advertising industry having to deal with personal shoppers, and like how do you advertise for, you know, agents that are shopping? And so where we once were, it's like the physical world was like the trial run for where we're heading into like the virtual
or
world.
Or was it?
Yeah.
I don't know. So there's the whole thing about Norbert Wiener's, like, who's the father of cybernetics. sorry. Yep.
Francis gotcha. Just did a, like a little
spitting. Lost it. Yep.
Who's that?
Yeah. Great name. It's always funny to me when I go.
Is it
to,
Ghibli?
Like,
is it Ghibli? Is it Wiener? Is it Viner?
Look, no. That as we were talking, know. I realized, look, these things are called Claude and Dolly for
yeah,
a reason.
For a reason.
It's like. It's not called Sam Altman. It's like in Succession where they're like, it sure as shit doesn't say Shiv. It's like, if you, it's like, you know, nobody would care about your product if you named it after yourself. You have to name it after somebody who actually achieved something.
So let's hear about Norbert Wiener.
Yeah, let's roll tape Norbert Wiener.
Whenever I end up doing my salons, I always like read something ahead of time. And it's either, this is for real, actually. Yeah. It's either Balzac or Wiener that I end up reading.
Yeah.
That's for real.
That's okay.
We don't have time to unpack that right now.
Oh, okay, fine. We'll do that later. off cam, off mic.
He's a very good orator. He's a wonderful... I love your reading selections, Brian.
Well, thank you, Philip. Norbert Wiener was the father of cybernetics. He influenced like AI development as we know it. He wrote a book called The Human Use of Human Beings. He also wrote a book called God and Golem Incorporated. Super interesting, highly worth a read. Both of those, they're short, easy reads. And he perfectly predicts the rise of AI, exactly how it would like be started as a closed system. Eventually, it would defeat humans in the game Go. I don't know if you all remember when like AI AlphaGo. Was
yeah.
yeah AlphaGo or whatever yeah so yeah the
a machine could defeat me in literally any game like that you know what I mean I'm just like wow of course like
yeah
and you were exactly. the best of us Daisy
yeah not at games yeah. though
I love a good game we'll have to play a game at some point and I guess I'll defeat you but the he says that there are some things that should be human-to-human interactions, some things that should be human-to-machine interactions, and some things that should be machine-to-machine interactions. And our job is actually to categorize and pursue what those things are. And so a lot of the frustration that we feel often has to do with inputs that should be human-to-human or maybe just directly machine-to-machine that we end up putting in the human-machine bucket. And so I think that as we like pursue things, like actually the entire internet, and this gets into like McLuhan, and I brought him up because we can all. Like,
I mean, I said it that first. That was, we have a drinking game.
Look,
yes.
I love McLuhan.
Yeah, we
have just did a study group commerce on with Andrew.
Oh, I love
oh, yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Were you guys in that?
No, we weren't.
Everyone's just like cameras off. I started scrolling through the Zoom. I was like, oh, this is really a who's who situation. Yeah,
talking about a scene.
Andrew's the best. Yeah. He just wrote for Lore, our book.
Yeah. Andrew is Marshall McLuhan's grandson.
That's right.
For the uninitiated.
Yes. I just read my novella on his radio show a few weeks back. It was fun. The thing is, like, all information is washing over us continuously. I would posit that potentially we're not even supposed to interact with the internet as it exists today. Like, that is not a human-to-machine interaction that we should have going on. It's too much. And that's why we're, like, overwhelmed and our attention's over the top and, like, we're working all the time and like we need proxies and we need an OSHA for the minds. Like we are at the point now where like we are in an industrial revolution for the minds. And that's actually Norbert Wiener as well. He said that all decision-making is like being outsourced, like low-level decision-making is being outsourced to machines. And that's part of this new industrial revolution that's happening in our minds. And I think that we are interacting with machines in a way that is making us less human. And like, I think that's what a lot of the stuff that we're all chatting about and like figuring out in terms of like culture and good taste and bad taste, a lot of that has to do with being conformed to machines because we have to for efficiency.
Okay, here's an angle on this I want to get into. So online shopping, commerce, if you will, e-commerce, if you will. What's that app, Doji? Philip, I've been seeing you playing
with Twitter. Doji, yeah.
Yeah,
oh, where you can, because I might be trying
where you can like set up. Well, okay, but where you
I know
you
what
can,
Doji like, is, you know, though. Yeah.
Digital
yeah.
avatar, and you can like try on clothes in it. I haven't used that because what I'm about right now is trying to move away from buying clothes on the internet, unless it's something I've tried on online and it was too expensive in a shop. And now it's like 3 months later, and it's on sale. I have wasted hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars over the past decade plus on, like, you know, I bought a thing and it looked really cool on the internet. I could imagine how it would look on me. So good. Wow. I look awesome. I get it. It doesn't really fit me. Maybe I return it and, like, you know, it's caused me some like hours then of like kind of mental suffering in like thinking how cool it would be and like wasting my time thinking about this object that I want to buy and then buying it. Anyways, rambling a bit here. I think with Doji though, I'm like, I'm already agonizing about how something would look on me when I won't actually know until I have it on my body and I can see if, like, am I even between sizes? Does this even fit me? So I think, yeah, that I'm very bullish on in-person shopping, at least when it comes to clothes. I'm trying to like detox from online clothing shopping because it has made my life worse.
So we had a launch party for Blank last Thursday at this beautiful shoppable design gallery in a 5-story townhouse in the West Village called The Future Perfect. It also has locations in San Francisco and LA. And we did this with Chantal, which is, if you listen to the first half of the other half of this conversation
over on the Future Commons feed,
Chantal is a lingerie brand, a French lingerie brand, family owned, that's been around since the late 1800s. They are the launch sponsor for Blank, our new books newsletter. And we activated their global campaign of something more by like doing something more and basically gathering all of these people in this beautiful place. And I was like, what am I going to wear to this? Right. Like, and I ended up, okay, I really try to steer away from fast fashion. But I had this vision of like what I wanted to wear. And there was this particular neckline that I wanted, which is like this reverse halter, which, you know, we're men, but basically instead of like the strap coming up the front and going around the back of your neck, it comes from the back and goes around the front of your neck. So I thought that looked pretty cool. And then I was like, so I ordered it from Amazon, $15, right? I'm like, am I really wearing an Amazon top to this like, you know, fancy party? But then I was like, I had another vision, which was I was going to modify the top so that in the back, sort of playing off this idea of like what's in the front, what's in the back, I pinned two strands of pearls, the two pearl necklaces I have, I think one of them's fake and one of them's real, into the back straps, basically creating like a double pearl necklace in the back of the top. And I was like, this looks awesome. And I do not DIY my clothes that much. I grew up sort of doing it. My mom sews. And I really don't know what inspired me to do this because I really frankly don't shop that much these days either for all the reasons Francis listed. It's the decision fatigue. It's the negative experience of online shopping. But this like weird, like fast fashion DIY thing came together so well. I got so many compliments on it. And like halfway through the night, I was like, oh, you know, this top's from Amazon. And like, I pinned that in the back. But it really like inspired me to be more creative. I'm like, why don't I do this more? I know why I don't do it more. It's because I like thinking about what I'm wearing on a day-to-day basis has like a diminishing return unless it's like a special event like this. But I do think like I miss that creativity. And even people who are very creative in what they are wearing, I think online shopping takes some of the creativity out of it for them because there's something really special about putting together things that you already have. And that is where style really shines beyond fashion. And we really don't have a culture of like putting together the things that you already have right now.
This
we
is
have
a taste conversation.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It does. Everything comes back to taste.
So
right?
Wait, real quick. One thing I want to add to this and then I'll hand it over to you guys. There's this store I've been to a few times recently in Carroll Gardens in Brooklyn called Ven Space. And the guy, I think his name is Chris, who started it, he used to be at Need Supply, which I think was down in Virginia.
Oh, sick.
It was a physical store. And then they did a lot of e-com. Then they shut down. It's an amazing store.
Leather jacket is from there. I was wearing it this morning.
Very nice. Yeah. So amazing store. I did buy something there, but you know, it was expensive. It's the type of store I can only go once or twice a year to buy something. But the way they hang things, their hangers are like covered in cloth such that you can't see the label of the item unless you're really like, oh, let me take this off. Like, okay, what is this? And it's that to me is so like the opposite of an e-commerce experience where I have to go and I have to physically engage with it. And I'm actually forced to be like, well, do I like this fabric? Does the cut of this look nice? And then obviously, you know, you take it off and you try it on, you can see what the brand is, but it's kind of forcing you to use your senses and like make decisions about, well, am I going to go take this and try this on based on your taste?
That's a wow. So that's, I'm really into that. So we,
you use Doji. I saw you.
I use Doji a lot.
yeah.
But I think
no judgment there. The Doji thing is
that
just like,
cool.
I've tortured myself. Cool,
I draw the line. I'm like, I'll use Doji, but don't catch me with a Studio Ghibli meme. I'm not, that's where I draw the line. And so
you leveled up, with Doji a little bit.
So yeah. So I guess, so I've had a, this, I might wander into weird personal territory, so like decide if you want to keep this or not. But like, this was my, well, last week was my eight years. Where are we? 2017. We're 2025. 8 year running anniversary. Years. 8 years ago, I was 334 pounds. And so I, you know, I had a big life change. And I, you know, for me, I was one way for a good portion of my life. I grew up in a bakery. My mom was a baker, had a lot of different habits. And so I didn't like fashion wasn't a thing for me. And, my life was very different at one point. So I'm kind of like just discovering a lot of things, by the way, couldn't shop online no matter where, like a lot of these things were inaccessible to me, generally. And I didn't really have a style when I lost a lot of weight. Most of my style was like capsule wardrobe stuff that I just like, I bought a ton of stuff. And then it was like the pandemic. So like, I didn't really have a style, just to be honest with you. Doji has been interesting. I don't know that I see Doji as like a virtual try-on app necessarily. It's been quite limited. Doji, I think, is like this secret third thing. It's not like, it's like virtual avatar solution that like is almost like virtual clothing. It's almost like a digital avatar, but it's becoming a like a third party it looks like they're trying to become a third party platform for brand collaborations. That seems like to be what they're doing right now, so that they can, you know, partner with brands like Essence, even though I think that maybe they've stolen a lot of Essence's catalog to train their content. I don't know how they're pulling that off. That's going to be a coup. But what's really interesting about Doji is, just having played around with it, is it's interesting because it feels like it's slowed down the pace of my immediacy and my expectation of getting immediate feedback from AI. It feels like it's actually caused me to become more patient. All of these image generation tools made me more patient with AI feedback. And it feels like the pace of immediacy, especially in all of our consumption habits in e-commerce, require like immediate feedback and demand, and like our customer expectation cycles require like this immediate feedback loop. Like all of our expectations have been on this exponential curve, but image generation for some reason have really reset that expectation level for us to like hit a button and walk away. And I think that's really healthy for us. Like we need to get back to a place where we have lower expectations and like asynchronous expectations of our relationship with computing, where we do something and we go away. And Doji did that. Doji said, hey, we're going to style you. You go away for 5, 10, 15 minutes, and we'll let you know when you're styled and you come back. Mm. And you know what? It's funny. ChatGPT's done the same thing. The image generation is not instant. It's 5, 6, 7 minutes sometimes for an image to come through, but it's a high quality image when it comes back. And Doji does the same thing too. I think people are willing to wait when it's a higher quality outcome. And that's what I've seen with this, you know, with this. I've used it a little bit with like, I like that jacket. So I take that jacket link and I shove it into Doji. Sometimes, you know, I wrote a piece for Future Commerce. every now and then it'll turn me into a black man. I don't know what that's about. So I don't know. There's some problems inherent in the system, but generally I've had a pretty good experience with it.
I didn't know that it took time to generate. That's a very desktop computer. There's just the desk and that's where you go in the internet era.
Desktop is the place.
True.
It's the place you go to.
Two things that I think out of that conversation, Francis, that you hit on there. I really believe in embodiment as a trend. I think that the ecology of the internet is disembodiment. And that was an Andrew McLuhan thing. I think that he just tweeted about that the other day. But that I think that the future of the internet, actually Doji is an extension of the future digital experience that we don't have yet. I don't know if that makes any sense. Like, I believe that there is a future, like, internet world, digital world, where we're going to interact with people and each other. There's going to be a verified and an unverified component to it. And I think that that's something that we're coming up against right now. And that's why LinkedIn is hitting for a lot of people, because it is one of the most verified social platforms. But I believe that there's going to be
it's hitting something.
It's hitting something. Oh, no, trust me. I hate LinkedIn.
I can't say
so
if it's
much.
Hitting anything good. Francis and I have talked about this too. Yeah.
No, but oddly, people are exiting Twitter for LinkedIn. And I guess it makes sense. People use Twitter to try to advance their careers. Like, the answer
for escape
internet,
Elon or whatever. I don't, you
yeah,
know,
yeah, maybe it something. Is. Not Blue Sky, whatever. Like, but I do think that there
know.
Is like
Blue Sky.
Body as
I just can't. I'm not going to say the word skeet out loud. Yeah, sorry.
About to.
We also have Norbert Wiener. So yeah,
we're deep in.
Yeah. Sorry, Brian. Go on.
No. Future internet is Doji is an extension of it. I think it's this disembodiment idea, and then we haven't fully wrapped our heads around what disembodiment means.
Controversial thought, though. If we pre-develop things for the future internet, does that get in the way of us actually achieving that future?
Yes, I would. I think so.
I don't know. Actually,
I feel like
I don't
we're
know.
In the mid-curve version of the future right now.
I don't know.
Where
we're so
just
early.
Kind of
remember
shitty.
That?
We were supposed to have flying cars.
We were supposed
I think,
to have
well, okay, this reminds me of one of my favorite things about the Cybertruck. I read...
A Cybertruck was parked in my spot outside of
listen,
my
Okay,
house.
So last year I read that quite questionable Elon Musk... biography by Walter Isaacson or Walter, whatever his name is. Anyways, there's a detail. The one detail that really sticks with me is he's talking about designing the Cybertruck, and he says that his like then 8-year-old son or whatever was like, why don't cars look like the future?
Yeah.
And so he said, oh, well, then we'll make a car that looks like the future. But it's like, to me, it's this anachronistic vision of the future that is what he's Elon Musk is like 40 something, 50. I don't know. So it's like when he was a kid, when he was like 12 in like 1982 or whatever, that's what he would have thought cars
right,
would look
and it
like
just happens
that's
to like look like an armored car
yeah.
in South Africa.
So this is that. So this is what we're just talking about, where it's like if you're like that is making something for this future that was imagined 50 years ago that doesn't represent the present or any actual future. It's this refusal to like actually engage with a possible future.
Francis, stop me if I've said this before, but like why does Waymo have to look like a car? Like I know the car shape has been tested before and like crash test dummies and the way that things are tested is with a car shape, so it makes sense, but like I want to ride around in an Apple like the busy town worm. And I believe that I should be allowed to.
I think you will in the future actually. My hot take is the future of mobility is actually like closer to like inflatables than it is the current car section we have right now. Like I'm writing a short story called Cushioned, and it's about how the future is like textiles. That's the future. Like,
send it to me.
I will.
TM, trademark that.
You could have written that 150 years ago when they invented rubber shoes.
Oh, have you read the Inflato Cookbook?
Who no. I mean?
Do you know about it?
No.
Oh my God. I'm about to put you onto something. So this is like almost like the anarchist cookbook, but instead of for making bombs, it's for making inflatable environments, like inflatable geodesic dome. And
oh,
this
so
actually ended
this.
Up and almost ended up in a short story that I did when I was at summer camp. The director of the boys camp was a teacher during the year, and he did something with his students that was an inflatable whale that he had built that was to the dimensions, I believe, of like a blue whale.
And that's so he cool. set it up for us at camp to go in. And it was like, you know, you put the fan in it, almost like when you do the thing with the parachute and you sit under it. But it was the body of a whale that he had made out of plastic. And you could go inside of the inflatable whale. And anyway, I will send the Inflato cookbook to you. It's like on Wayback Archive. It's a PDF around the internet. But I am super, inspired by it. And it is a... Even inflatables are a past vision of the future, but I would 100% rather ride around in a clear inflatable car that looks like something I bought at in the Limited 2 catalog in 2003 than a Volvo.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, wait. I'm changing the topic actually. So finish.
Go on. Well,
I was gonna. Well, it's your show, so you can do what you want. I was gonna loop back around to put a bow on this idea of like, are we building a new future? Are we like fulfilling the prophetic, you know, vision of the past? I do think a new vision of the future, because the old vision of the future of all desktop computing, right, was to be, you know, somewhat skeuomorphic. Like we had to. Recreate old paradigms and old analog ideas in digital space so that we had, you know, some like on-ramps, like teaching people how to have metaphors in a digital space. And then we evolved past that. So now we have like purely digital metaphors that had no analogs in the real world. So what comes after that? And we've been theorizing that for about 5 years at Future Commerce. So like around 2019, we wrote a couple pieces that talked about what's next. Like, what is the next consumer? in a purely post skeuomorphic environment. And then what is the next web interface post that as well? Because we've optimized all the life out of the web. We are absolutely as optimized as you can get. You can't get more optimized, especially in commerce. Amazon has figured that out. Like you can't make people buy more. We've found the platonic ideal. In fact, Ruby Talo and Reggie James had a panel at Visions Summit. Shout out. We have another Vision Summit at MoMA June 10th. Check it out. That's my plug. But, you know, they held up their phones and they're like, this is the platonic ideal. We're never going to evolve past this. What's that?
Are you holding up your Notes app right now?
No, it's not. This is my Android because I'm that guy. But this is
naturally.
What does it say?
It says the time. It's 12:05.
Oh, okay.
It's just black.
You don't have like a cool background?
Well, I can turn it on and then it's just a green screen.
Oh, mine is my husband.
I could have your husband on my background too.
That would
if you
be
like.
A good bit. Maybe are you the person who keeps Googling Daisy Alioto husband?
Yeah, I am that
guy. We got him, folks. We got him.
Yeah, this is like it's just weird. Stop doing that, Philip. Websites haven't really evolved, right? Phones aren't really going to evolve. Everything has sort of reached like I don't even know if it's a local maxima. Like we've reached almost like a universal maxima. We can't evolve past it because we've reached a platonic ideal. Like this is the ultimate form. We can't break out of the form. The automobile is another great example. We are in a 125 year long platonic ideal of the form of the automobile.
You know, another example here. This I think this is political. Is what was it? A couple months ago, that guy Jerry Connolly was elected to be the head of some committee, and I think it was like AOC running against him or something. Mm. And they elected him, and I forget if it was him saying it or somebody else, but they were saying it was his turn. But this is this old man who looks in poor shape and like, you know, probably a younger person should be in power here. And I think of the average age of members of Congress today, it's much higher, decades higher than it was like 50, 60 years ago. Hmm. So I don't know if this is some like end of history thing, but I think this is all connected to what you're talking about.
Skeuomorphism is design gerontocracy.
It is. And the phone and like, and being stuck in car world. And what this is though too is like, is
I hate car world.
It has to be at a level of like these businesses, these companies, these corporations, people who, you know, it's very lucrative for these things not to change and to not engage with like maybe more like social issues that could actually progress things. And maybe that's part of why we're stuck in these forms.
I agree. I also think that maybe things aren't like, okay, we can intellectual, you know, we can do the intellectual thing.
This is capital,
but
stuff.
But if we just talk about like, you know, it's also really difficult to get everybody to like coordinate on big change. So like, sometimes it takes calamity to like make things change on big scale. Like sometimes things just have to happen to break the system, and breaking the system has to come at a cost. So for instance, you know, ADA compliance is one of the things in that broke was a big shift in 1990 that changed a lot of physical infrastructure. So there's a law that came out in 1990 that was in the United States that changed a lot of physical infrastructure, made a lot of retrofit of a lot of physical access for a lot of buildings, government buildings first, and then retail establishments. And now ADA has been interpreted for website access, but it's not a law. It's being tried as case law. So you have millions of websites now are all having to be retrofit to be accessibly accessed. Why? Because there's a lot of professional plaintiffs that are going around suing websites, mom and pop websites, individual proprietors that are just being sued for to the tunes of $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a pop and settling out of court because they're not accessible. They're not compliant. But it was never the spirit of the law, right? Mm-hmm. So we're reinforcing this like best practice environment. We're reinforcing and putting more like constraints on our ability to be creative in the web. We're further entrenching ourselves in this boring sea of sameness and homogenization of the current boring environment that we have. And we're like locking ourselves into for the next 50 years of the platonic ideal of the website because of the system that we have. The only thing that will undo this is, I think, the ability for users to have ultimate control of their own experience, which I think the AI, you know, design systems can give us. Web. Yeah, they can bring it them BYO, you know, so, see, okay, bring your
creative. There's a quote I want to read from you in this commerce on the Commerce Tools website interview you did recently.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
The idea, because I'm very, I love the idea that we've gone too far with frictionlessism. Yeah. You say the idea of removing friction has been overhyped. We've optimized e-commerce sites to the point where they all look the same. In our 2022 research study, we removed branding from major retailers' sites like Target and Crate and Barrel, and consumers couldn't tell them apart. That's because we've A/B tested everything into uniformity. We're so afraid of friction. However, friction can be good. It creates discovery, engagement, and even emotional attachment. I love that.
I mean, tires need a little bit of friction. Sex needs a little bit of friction. Like, so you need a little friction, right? Too much friction, it's bad.
Food needs texture. I mean, going back to what we were talking about before with the natural cycle of culture being counterculture, integrated into culture, and then sort of like retroubled by the fringe, I feel like technologists have had to reinvent, come up with this idea of accelerationism as almost like a first principles reinvention of what naturally happens during culture, because technology like interrupted
first principles reinvention
that entropy. Natural cultural reset. It's like, you know, it's like how you have to do like controlled burns for you know, developed
forest fires,
like semi-developed ex-urban spaces, because this sort of like natural burn cycle has been disrupted by development. It's like accelerationism has become this sort of like controlled burn idea that technologists are trying to impose on the cultural and political environment as something that you have to like create. But the whole idea around accelerationism is like, you don't have to create it. Cycles of change happen naturally. If you disrupt it, then whatever accelerationism that you then try to impose is basically like inorganic shock doctrine. Like this idea that the economy has to be, that you have to like impose a program of pain onto the economy to refresh what's happening in employment and manufacturing. Like, you wouldn't need to do that if you hadn't like broken the welfare system and both the welfare system and the free market to begin with. Acceleration shouldn't even be a principle or an ideology. It's like, it's a lack of ideology. It's like saying that entropy is your political system. Entropy is something that happens naturally on the unfolding of time. But now we have people who are like, they're basically inventing like fake solutions to problems that they created rather than having the humility to say, hey, maybe like we should let culture unfold the way that it's always unfolded, because these big changes and inflection points, like the saturation point around the ADA, like the saturation point around the civil rights movement, like the saturation point that will happen, I'm very sure in the next 10 years around healthcare, will happen whether you impose shock doctrine or not. And you are really, the thing that you are changing is basically like how violent and uncivilized it's going to be. That's the only thing that you have control over, because it's going to happen no matter what.
There's a, and I'm saying like, it's totally, these are good things that have done a lot of good things for people. Like the Americans with Disabilities Act is wonderful. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have it, right? But there's secondary and tertiary effects that come 30, 40 years down the line that you can never foresee, especially when technology shifts happen. And I have to wonder, you know, we're also on the precipice of, I lived through the early internet. I remember what the life, what life was like before the internet, because I grew up without the internet, and things were really rosy in the beginning. And then we had computer viruses, and we had, you know, ransomware, and we had, like, we have not seen any of that sort of thing happen yet with AI either. And so there, we have a whole wave of disillusionment that needs to happen still too, where there's still lots of things to come. And so, you know, I think when I talk about calamity that has to enter the system for massive things that need to change, is like, that's where I think there's an opportunity for us to have a reset button, especially with regard to, you know, giant shifts in cultural acceptance of like normative design. And that's where I think there will be an opportunity. I'm not saying that like, it's not necessarily a good thing, and it'll be painful. You could even say like, I'm almost advocating for that. I'm not saying I am advocating for it, but at Future Commerce, like, that's sort of what we do, is we're sort of predicting that like things kind of get to a breaking point. And we're sort of saying, we've been saying for a few years that like, how long can the system persist as is with, you know, everybody sort of expecting ever persistent growth out of a system that can no longer sustain an ever growing number of brands with an ever present boring state of affairs. So that's kind of where we are. But that's a really boring and depressing place to end. So
for me, it's all this fuss over something, you know, that for me, like, I think pretty much everything that we talk about in this space is superseded by a campfire with friends and a cigar. Like, I think that there are primitive things that humans love that people don't even realize how much they would enjoy or how much they do love, that are life-giving, that are going to come back and are necessary. To your point, Francis, like the embodiment of shopping, I think that there's more embodiment necessary for the future to be human friendly. And so my hope is that we can use technology to do the things that technology does and get into what Norbert Wiener talked about, like letting machines do what they're good at and letting humans do what they're good at. And so as we get into like a discussion of taste, like, I think there is a push, like, I think taste requires all the senses, to our point earlier. Like, we need to be more human, and that's where I would leave this.
100%. I saw a meme yesterday that was like two visions of longevity, and one side it's like Brian Johnson in a blood bag, and the other side it's like an old shirtless Italian man in an espresso. And it's like,
totally,
me and old Italian men just have an understanding. We inherently understand each other. Like, I know which side I'm falling on. And I think increasingly people, it's the campfire cigar thing. That is what humans are good at.
Totally.
I think that's a great place to end it. Guys, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was a pleasure. And if you have listened all the way to the end here, then there is no way you would not enjoy our appearance on Brian and Phillip's podcast that is also out right now. So go listen to it. See you next week.